growing up, one of my favorite authors, because I grew up down south, was William Faulkner, and he had this famous quote that's more or less like, history is not history. It's, in fact, it's not even past. And I feel the same way, in a way, about policy and about the different dynamics that we see in the marketplace and in the broader, you know, English learner sphere. A lot of what we do today is grounded in what happened yesterday, and it's really important to know that.
Hey everybody, welcome back to Highest Aspirations, an education podcast from Elevation Education that explores how we can help make an impact on our nation's highest growing student demographic, multilingual learners. I'm your host, Steve Sofronis. As we approach the end of Season 10 of Highest Aspirations, I wanted to make some time to bring in a guest who I've gotten to know quite well over the last 7 years. In fact, he is one of the big reasons I get to do this podcast, and more importantly, one of the reasons educators and students around the country get to use Elevation in so many different ways. In addition to being Elevation's president and co-founder, he also happens to be our in-house policy wonk. One of his favorite parts of his job is to facilitate a session for new Elevation employees he calls EL Policy and Market Landscape. It has been a highlight of the onboarding process for new hires ever since Elevation was founded over 10 years ago. I remember my session the week I was hired back in June of 2016, and recognizing the value of the information he shares in this session and the many sessions that he's run over the years, we have finally attempted to share some key elements in this interview. Here are some of the key questions we'll explore in this podcast episode. What are some key rulings during the history of EL policy, and what is their impact on education equity and access? What challenges are multilingual learners currently facing in education, and how have policies helped overcome or exacerbate them? How can we better advocate for English learners in policy and legislation? We discuss these questions and much more with Elevation co-founder and president and in-house policy wonk, Teddy Rice. As always, thanks for listening to Highest Aspirations, and I hope you enjoy the conversation. Teddy Rice, welcome back to Highest Aspirations.
Thanks for having me, Steve. Nice to be here.
Yeah, this is, I think, your second or third appearance, which seems like not too many, given we have over 200 episodes at this point. So I'm excited to welcome you back. This time, we have a specific topic we're going to talk about that you're kind of famous for. So you ready to dive in?
I'm ready. I'm going to do my best and not to embarrass myself.
Okay. I think you're going to be fine. So here's the context. You're kind of famous around here at Elevation for not only being the co-founder of our company, but also being kind of our in-house policy wonk. I've heard you be called that many times by many people. And one of your kind of wonky responsibilities is to provide some historical context on multilingual education for new hires. I started Elevation in 2016. You'll hopefully be happy to know that I still have a vivid memory, and my memory is not great, but I have a vivid memory of that session. It was really informative, but you also have a really kind of unique way of presenting what might be considered a little bit of a dry topic to many people.
Yeah.
I know it continues to be kind of a highlight of the onboarding experience for newer members, and it's a presentation that I know you've tweaked over the years. So we thought we'd kind of recreate that experience for our listeners, because it's relevant, obviously, to anybody who's working with multilingual learners. So I want to start with having you talk a little bit about just first the why behind it. Why is this historical context that we'll get into, historical policies, important for those of us serving multilingual learners?
Yeah, so boy, this is a fun topic for me, as you said. You know, internally at Elevation, I think it's always important for people to have context for the work that they're doing. Why is it important? Why is it purposeful? Why does it happen the way it does? And, one of my favorite authors, because I grew up down south, was William Faulkner. And he had this famous quote that's more or less like, history is not history. It's, in fact, it's not even past. And I feel the same way, in a way, about policy and about the different dynamics that we see in the marketplace and in the broader, you know, English learner sphere. A lot of what we do today is grounded in what happened yesterday, and it's really important for people to know that. I also think it's really important just for, you know, the wider community we serve to have some of this background as well. I mean, internally at Elevation, I feel like it's our responsibility to know some of this stuff, But I think most of the people we serve think of themselves very much as advocates for English learners and parents, families of kids. And that's one of the things that makes our job really fun. And I think they will be and can be better advocates for English learners and multilingual families if they have, you know, some of the grounding in this. So that's why I think it's important.
Yeah. And I, you know, we're on the same page there. And we were having this conversation internally about how do we get the word out on this and kind of give a little primer. That's why we kind of thought about your presentation. So I'm going to start kind of, so here's how this works. I reviewed your presentation, your slides that you use for new hires. It's changed a little bit since I did mine back in 2016. And I kind of took out what I thought would be the most relevant and most important pieces to our audience. Mm-hmm. But I'm going to start where you kind of usually start, which is the legal environment pre and post the year 1954. So tell us what happened. Some of our listeners, I'm sure, will know. But for those that don't, what happened that year and in subsequent years that helped shape the regulatory environment, which we all work? And maybe like give us a little glimpse of what it was like prior to 1954 for multilingual learners and the educators who served them, or just, you know, education in general, how it pertains to our demographic.
Yeah, sure. So 1954 is a critical year. Anyone who was schooled here in the United States would probably have spent a lot of time on this year and this topic in civics course or U.S. history in 11th grade or whatever it is. This is the famous Brown versus Board of Education decision, which for the first time established that separate was not equal. And until 1954, starting with the Plessy versus Ferguson decision in 1896, separate was in fact equal or was satisfactory in the eyes of the law. And the Earl Warren Court, which was a more progressive court at the time, heard a case coming out of Topeka, Kansas, I think it was, that basically began to dismantle the Jim Crow policies of segregation. And the decision at the time was mostly focused on African-American segregation, mostly in the South. Mm-hmm. And I grew up down in Virginia where, you know, the history of this period is not, it's not pleasant if you're from Virginia. This is was not Virginia's finest hour, but it was always an interesting thing to learn about because, you know, at that moment, the Southern states really kind of dug in, and there was about 10 years of time that passed before anything really meaningful happened in terms of integration in the schools. But, you know, over that period of time, you start to see the Dr. King beginning to lead his movement, the Montgomery bus boycotts, et cetera. And you see this really interesting dynamic after Kennedy's assassination in 1963, where the Southern resistance in the Senate was kind of finally kind of surrendered to the LBJ Great Society legislation. And even though Brown v. Board happens in 1954, a lot of the kind of legal response to that in terms of trying to ensure a more equitable kind of society, including with schools, starts to like be evident in the legislation. So you start Civil Rights Act, Voting Rights Act. There's a whole number of acts, mm-hmm. like count of them all. And I start there at Elevation, and I think it's good to start here in this discussion because people who are in our field, who are in the classrooms working with multilingual kids should know that their work is absolutely grounded in the civil rights movement. It's like, right. Civil rights movement of now is supporting marginalized students within classrooms. I don't think it's like a massively controversial thing to say. I think it still remains very true. But what's interesting about Brown versus Board of Education is that it establishes this notion of separate's not equal, right? But that becomes more expansively understood to include, you know, Native Americans. This is when you start to see the Chicano movement, mm-hmm. led by Chavez out in California, leading the migrant farm workers and the like. And it's also when certain lawyers begin to identify that English language learners were also excluded from classrooms, almost as if they were in their own separate kind of classroom in the same way that the plaintiff in Brown v. Board had been.
Yep.
And in 1972... there's a child in who I've never seen an interview with her. I don't know if she's ever been interviewed, but her last name was Lau. She came out of Chinatown in San Fran, USD, where most of the kids spoke Chinese. And Nichols was the superintendent at the time of San Fran Unified. And at the time in San Francisco and in every other school district, there was no expectation that school districts provide services to English learners. Like it was kind of sink or swim. You'd come in.
Yep.
The teacher would be like the Charlie Brown teacher at the front, wah, 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 because like no one could understand the standard. And not that that was coming from necessarily from any mean-spirited place. It's just like literally there was no expectation that districts, that this was a responsibility.
Sure. Yeah.
And after Law v. Nichols, the Supreme Court unanimously decides, as it did with Brown, that that districts had an obligation to serve English learners and to make the content accessible to them through language services. And for our field, for the people who are in our business, and by the way, like I'm talking here presumably to lots of people who've gotten their ESOL endorsements and have been, gotten their master's in EL policy and the like, and everyone, all of them will know about LAO. It's like kind of a standard part of the course.
Sure.
But those who don't, like this is kind of the Brown versus Board version for English learners. It's right. It's traditional. And after that, we can get more into it, but like the law then follows this concept and you begin to see the beginnings of the Bilingual Education Act, which then morphs into Title III of the Elementary and Secondary Education Act. And we begin to offer the federal government begins to play a role in helping districts serve kids, both with funding through Title III and some other programs, and by way of enforcement, by ensuring that schools are on the hook for delivering these kinds of services.
Right. Yeah, no, I think that's helpful. And I know, you know, I one thing that I hate doing is preaching to the choir here, but I honestly don't think that we are. I think that there are many people who understand this, obviously, that are grounded in this history. But I think a review and kind of putting it in context of the work that we're doing is always useful. And in a bit, we'll kind of dive into more of the how, you know, instead of the why and the what. But before we do, like, so you get into, so that's a great history to have, and it kind of gives us a foundation. And then, you know, I was in education for 17 years, and I'll totally be vulnerable and admit here that while I sort of lived through No Child Left Behind and a part of Every Student Succeeds Act, I, as a classroom teacher, that was very kind of highfalutin for me. That was like not, I liken it often to like, and this is probably not the best way to describe it, but I'll do it this way because I think it makes sense. Like there's a general, right, who's running the show in some campaign that's happening in some battle somewhere. And as a teacher, like I'm on the ground, my biggest concern are the people next to me, like my students, my fellow teachers. And so the general gives an order that's five levels above me. All I know is what I have to do right now and tomorrow. And so I think that's the world in which a lot of people are living as teachers, especially now, given all the stress and extra responsibility. So if you could like give an overview of high level, you know, policy, like No Child Left Behind and Every Student Succeeds Act and sort of what's the impact or the legacy in some cases from these and how does it affect us now and why is it important to know?
Yeah, they're really important laws to understand and they've had a huge impact on our field and certainly our company. I love your analogy about kind of being a troop on the ground and trying to, I'll try to relate it to like what these laws have meant for the experience of a teacher. I'll try to kind of ground it in that.
Yeah. And yeah.
To the best I can, because, you know, full transparency, I haven't been a teacher.
Well, I can take on that role. I'll call you out.
So starting with No Child Left Behind, I laugh about because I think by the end of No Child Left Behind in 2015 or so, I think it was like one of the world's most unpopular laws.
Yeah, I agree.
Conservatives hated it. Liberals hated it. There was wide agreement on how much they didn't like it. And that's what actually weirdly created the conditions for ESSA, Every Student Succeeds Act in 2015. It was like the only bipartisan thing that got done in that decade, you know? And it's because like everyone really mutually was disgusted with No Child Left Behind. But it's really important to know and acknowledge that No Child Left Behind at the beginning did some fabulously important things, especially for English learners. The most important thing it did and it required is that it, for the first time, it imposed these requirements on districts that they had to identify who their ELs were. And then each year, they had to measure those English learners' progress on a set of language proficiency assessments. Before 2001, districts didn't have to report out on who their English language learners were. They were not expected to show any growth on any kind of like language assessment, which today we would know as like WIDA or TELPASS or whatever LPAS. After No Child Left Behind, suddenly there's this new spotlight on these students. And that was uncomfortable for a lot of people. Like, one of the reasons why No Child Left Behind was unpopular is because people didn't like that transparency. Always.
Yep.
And but if you're an English learner, or if you're a multilingual family with students in school, you should feel you would have felt better knowing that someone was requiring the district to really break out separately the performance of those students and presumably doing something about it when that performance wasn't good. It also, for those same reasons, it created this whole, I'm not going to use the word industry, it's not quite the right word, but this like whole ecosystem around language proficiency. Mm-hmm. This is when WIDA begins to emerge, for example. And so the notion of actually having students demonstrate their proficiency against the four domains of language only emerges really at this time. Before then, the only people taking those kinds of assessments were like, you know, world languages folks who might want to demonstrate mastery of French if you're an English speaker, whatever. Yep. Or, you know, people in like corporate spheres or even like Department of Defense or intelligence agency type spheres. But sure. But the notion of like language assessment was really not a part of a K-12 context until then. So again, really unpopular law, but like, let's just acknowledge that for English learners and for Elevation and for the educators we serve, this was hugely important and gave them a lot of tools and created a regulatory framework that really was for the first time really supportive of growth for ELs.
Yeah, dig in a little bit there, because one thing that I think is important, and you kind of alluded to it, is that you're talking 2001, right? And so anybody who has taught now for, let's say, more than 20 years, which there's a lot of teachers, if I was still teaching, it would have been over 20 years for me, lived in a world in which prior to that, as you mentioned, there was no need to report out on the information for English learners. And so the reason that I mentioned that is because when we think about sometimes the resistance that we get, well, maybe resistance is the wrong word, but when you have, for example, content teachers who may have not worked with English learners before, and all of a sudden there's a demographic shift and now they need to, they're still in many ways, they're burdened with, number one, being content teachers first and language teachers second, the way that they were trained, not necessarily their fault, and the legacy of what happened, what was going on prior to that time. So yeah. I just pull that out because I think here is where the historical knowledge is important when communicating with teachers who may still be kind of like that legacy lives for a long time. We've seen that, right? And so it can be helpful to help kind of steer the ship and bring others along. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, it's absolutely the case that one of the flaws of No Child Left Behind, which I think has been to an extent corrected by the subsequent ESSA legislation. One of the flaws, in spite of some good stuff, which I just mentioned about No Child Left Behind, one of the flaws is that the policy was really oriented towards district administrators. The expectation was in any given district that the ELs were the responsibility of the EL coordinator and like her small team.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, God bless them. Like, that's better than probably what was happening in the 80s, but it still created this dynamic where classroom teachers, by and large, would view the responsibility of English learners as not theirs, but the responsibility of the EL teams. And so you used to always hear, the phrase, you know, well, those kids are, you know, that they belong with the ESL teacher.
Yep. Yep.
And, you know, what people in the field understood is that even kids who get a lot of intervention and personalized support from an ESL specialist still spend like 80 or 90% of their day in a classroom environment. And you're not going to learn English. You're certainly not going to learn academic language if you don't have classroom teachers who view it as their equal responsibility to ensure that all of the kids in their class have the language skills they need to access the content of the classroom. And so that was a problem in No Child Left Behind. That was when Elevation was started, by the way.
Sure.
We walked through, as you know, like old screenshots of the old first products of Elevation.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of clumsiness to the user experience, and there's a lot of weirdness in the way we priced things that like today people would like, they'd scratch their head as to why we did it that way. But it was mostly because of the way the districts were structured and the district teams had been structured to support English learners. There really wasn't the idea that like everyone would be on elevation as there is today. It was like, oh, there might be 8 people on elevation.
Yep.
So anyway, that's like a little, that's sort of a funny, like companies like elevation have to evolve with the policy as well.
Right.
And maybe that's a good segue to 2015. Cause I think
100%. That's what I was thinking. So like we covered the No Child Left Behind. You talked about the good, the bad. We got into like why there's it kind of how it affects the legacy of some teachers. Now we have Every Student Succeeds Act. What is kind of the good, the bad, and the ugly there? How is that how has that changed the landscape?
Yeah. Well, I mean, this is where, you know, the closer you get to the present, the harder it becomes to be a historian.
Yeah, exactly. I know.
And like the more actual political it gets. I mean, it's easy to talk about George W. and Teddy Kennedy like 30 years ago.
Yeah.
It's still in like a really tough moment right now, or like a living moment. But here, it's probably worth mentioning, like, what does ESSA solve? Like, what's the point of it, right? And basically, there were a couple of big complaints about the No Child Left Behind era. And I am not the exhaustive source of this, but I'll just try to limit it to like the English learner sphere. One big complaint from the sort of more conservative Republican side of the aisle was there's too much authority vested in the federal DOE. And there's too much authority for the DOE, the US DOE, to come in and penalize and sanction districts for lack of performance or growth or whatever it was. You know, for a political party or movement that's, you know, historically grounded in the idea of like more local control or keeping government close to the people, that was sort of a violation of that principle. And people really didn't like it. They also really didn't like Obama and Arne Duncan, and that probably played a personal role in it. So, but nonetheless, that was like a complaint. And then on the left side, on the Democrat coalition there, if you'd characterize it that way, you had a lot of grievances over what were totally unrealistic and sort of stupid expectations about standardized test proficiency expectations that really, to a lot of people, particularly in the teacher corps, felt like kind of dehumanizing and unrealistic and demoralizing. Like, and by the way, for the most part, like totally understandable, right?
Right, right.
And so you had this thing where you had these good things passed with No Child Left Behind, but you had these real grievances that were pretty good grievances.
I mean, legitimate, yeah.
Understandable grievances, right? And so ESSA comes along and like, amazingly, they're actually able to get some legislation passed. And again, there's like a million things going on here and like other people can speak much better to it. But from my point of view, there were a couple of things that are really important for English learners. One is, as the conservatives kind of wanted, a lot of the authority that had been formerly vested in, you know, the U.S. Department of Ed was more or less devolved down to the states. And so, you know, for us at Elevation and for a lot of the people we serve, it became less important what they were saying in D.C. and more important what they're saying in Sacramento and Austin. And
sure.
In the case of Massachusetts, where we're talking, you know, that would be Malden, where the DESE is.
Mm-hmm.
And so that actually like decentralized and devolved a lot of authority, which ended up creating more policy variability across the states, and made it important that we be more responsive to those different kinds of markets. And then the other thing that happened is that's a conservative win, let's say. I think the more liberal constituencies were pleased to see that most of the equity-oriented policy was preserved and even improved through different kinds of mechanisms, including like this requirement that these ESSA plans be formally approved by the US DOE. And that included a big focus on how states were going to support disadvantaged student populations. And I'm going to put multilingual learners in that bucket.
Mm-hmm.
And so a lot of good stuff that we were worried about losing in No Child Left Behind ended up being preserved, but a little bit more scattered.
Right.
And it's still kind of, I guess, an open question as to what kind of benefit has accrued to teachers. Bring it back to your very first question. What does it look like for teachers now? Well, I think one of the things that has certainly happened, I don't know that it's like totally widespread, But it is now, I think, understood that with respect to English learners, multilingual learners, teachers have an important responsibility to ensure that those students learn the language they need to be successful in the classroom. And it's not like they didn't care about that before, but now the principals actually have accountability to ensure that. And the notion that every teacher can be a teacher of language, which is something we've been saying for like a decade, is now actually more in the water and in the policy.
Yeah.
And there are certain places where the implications of that have been more dramatic than others. California is a pretty dramatic example, where it used to be that California districts had, I don't know, a couple hours of designated ELD each day,
yep,
where it's EL kids in a classroom and talk to them and quote unquote teach them English all day.
Sure.
Most California districts and schools aren't spending more than an hour a day, and often less. And it's much more about the integrated ELD. It's like, yeah, how do we integrate language supports within the content classrooms? And that's clearly aligned with, you know, a lot of the principles of sheltered instruction and popularized by, you know, organizations like SIOP and GLAAD and some others.
Yeah, I mean, the turnaround in California has been remarkable. That's we could do a whole other, you know, episode on that case study there, obviously.
Yeah, yeah. One last thing, Steve, which maybe this is a different topic, because I don't know that it comes out of ESSA per se, but something appears to have, and I don't know if this is a parallel development or a sequential development. I don't know if this is following because ESSA blazed the path, or if it's its own independent thing. This is where someone else could be smarter than me and know the answer. But I will say that one other thing that's really important is that there's a wider spread understanding and appreciation for the value of language and culture.
Yeah.
The laws that in particular had been in Massachusetts, California, Arizona, that required sort of English only instruction and prohibited bilingual education in many cases, those are falling by the wayside or have fallen by the wayside. And maybe it's because we're more of a multicultural country. I think it's to a significant extent because the research has been so powerful in favor of bilingual education. Mm-hmm. Wayne and Ginger, the great researchers out of Charlottesville, have been like foundational in pushing that research, for example. I think there's this really interesting and positive development where we're seeing more respect for native language, native culture, and how to include that in instruction. And not merely because there's all these like other like good cognitive benefits and stuff, but people now finally appreciate that it doesn't hurt you learning English to celebrate your native language. It actually helps you.
Right.
And like, that's a counterintuitive idea for a lot of people that the research is finally coming around to like debunking, basically.
Yeah. And I'm glad you kind of, sort of wrap that up with that statement, because I do see that and I do feel it, not only in the 7 years that I've been at Elevation and the 5 years or so that I've been doing the podcast and chatting with people about this, but also just in my other 17 years of being a teacher. There is definitely, I used to have a problem. Well, I don't, let me be clear. I don't have a problem with somebody saying every teacher should be a teacher of language and can be a teacher of language. I totally agree with that sentiment. And I think that that's an idealistic version of where we should be. I have a problem with that statement when everybody just believes that it's true, like blindly, mm-hmm, like, oh, every teacher is a teacher of language. But I would say that maybe 5 years ago, I would have really been more strongly on that end, saying, well, that's not necessarily the case. Whereas now I feel very differently. I feel like that message has been delivered in some way and received by many people. And I also feel like educators now have, through a variety of resources and programs and legislation and policy, they now have the ability to actually do that. Whereas before, if you were to ask a content teacher how they were going about doing that 10 years ago, and I was in the classroom, that's a tough thing for a lot of teachers, right? It's a tough thing to get their minds around. But that's changed, which is great. And like you, I don't know whether I think it's probably a combination of factors that kind of gets us into like the next piece of this conversation, which is the current state of where we are now. So we can, I think it sounds like we can agree that there's more of a sentiment of we can and should appreciate home language, that that teachers now have more tools and the ability to kind of work with their students to teach them the language, academic language that they need. Not necessarily happening to the extent that we would like it everywhere. We're trying to help with that, obviously, at Elevation. What do you think, given this, what we just said, the kind of biggest challenges are now that that we're facing? By we, I mean educators in the field kind of working with multilingual learners.
You know, I knew you'd ask this question, and I don't know that I have like the simplest answer. Let me start with like a bit of good news, and then I'll talk about what I think is maybe the harder news. So
love that approach.
I think the good news is I don't wake up in the morning or go to bed at night thinking that what the world really needs is like another like law to support English learners, or like there's like this major policy hurdle that we've got to knock down. There are other people on the listening end here who might totally disagree with me, but I look at the progress we've made over the last 10 years, and I'll give a shout out to like groups like Californians Together, for example, who like, boy, what a remarkable, like a remarkable success story about policy advocacy for bilingual education.
Unbelievable. I mean, we've had members of them on the podcast before. I got a chance to catch up with Martha Hernandez and others that are doing great work at CABE. I'm glad you shouted them out.
I mean, it's not just them, but it's like just an example of like what a small and mighty team can accomplish. And like, there's been other examples of this in other parts of the country as well. So I sort of look at the landscape, and maybe it's just like I'm getting old or something, but I'm like, oh, the bad old days like don't seem so bad. We've got policy in place that's really pretty respectful and supportive of English learners. Everyone wishes there was more money, but like there is money, which has been good. We've seen this movement towards bilingual education, dual language programming, which is like clearly to the good. There's like some wrinkles around equity and stuff, but like, you know, it's generally in the right direction. But so moving to the bad, I sort of think that the broader context is what I find to be bad. It's less about the EL specific stuff. It's just a lot of gray clouds that I think would make it hard to be a teacher today. And if I were to speak some to the specifics around English learners, it's, you know, we remain this unbelievable country that accepts kids from all over the place. And I know it's like super ugly in our politics a lot of times, and there's a lot of good reason to be discouraged by some of the immigration politics in our country. But just 2 years ago, there were literally 50,000 or more Afghan students that arrived in the United States. It was the largest single influx of a single language group in the United States since 1975, when South Vietnam collapsed.
Vietnam, yeah.
And this year, I'm sure it's going to be the Ukrainians. And then in the intervening years, it's a whole slew of kids, mostly from failed states in Central America.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not just that we're a country of immigrants, it's that the immigrants who are coming are arriving with like new levels of trauma that and are coming from all over the world with lots of different cultural lenses, right? That just make it super complex for teachers. And you know, we have Dallas is one of our big customers. We love Dallas ISD, and I was really impressed, but also very humbled by what they were able to do last year. I mean, they have a huge EL program. They have about 70,000 English learners, give or take, you know, a couple thousand, whatever. And last year, there were something like 15,000 of those kids were newcomers that were like literally new states, and almost all of them, you know, coming unaccompanied and the like. And one time we were on a call with them last year, and they had to abruptly stop the call because they had to rush over to the Dallas Cowboy football stadium in Arlington to supervise a soccer game for like hundreds of these kids, you know. And you think about that experience replicated all over the country in different ways in different school districts. And like, I'm sort of in awe of the work that our colleagues and customers are often doing.
Yeah.
But it's also what a load of work, you know. Mm-hmm. It's like definitely not the work of preparing for a lesson in class. It's like a lot of extra burdens. And then not to get too political about it, but like just the broader politics of like at local school level district stuff is just hard right now. And, you know, I'll refrain from getting too specific. It's a really touchy subject in a lot of communities, but it's difficult for teachers and principals and administrators to focus on the work of, you know, supporting complicated linguistically diverse classrooms when you're, you know, simultaneously really sort of frightened by some of the different, you know, political discourse happening at school boards and, you know, and you throw in school shootings and the like, which unfortunately, when you're like us and you serve like 40% of the schools in the country, like inevitably every day, like we hear of one in with people we serve. So there's just this, I think, like latent stress right now. I think the thing that I think is good news and the thing that I would focus on is helping districts and district leaders. First of all, I think we can help them give them the confidence that they can continue to do important work with great results. Like, this is not stuff that's mysterious anymore. We know how to make it, how to help English learners achieve their highest aspirations. And the work is just putting your shoulder down and knowing that you can, that when you put in the effort, you can get the results.
Yeah.
We see it every day, but it takes, I think, a certain spirit to get up every morning and do this work right now.
Yeah. You know, it reminds me of a couple things, a little anecdote. When I first started Elevation a few times, I'm waxing poetic about my beginnings, but you know, I was a classroom teacher for a long time and I had reservations about leaving the classroom, as I think every teacher does after teaching that long. And I was talking to our colleague, Ira Rigo, who I'll give a shout out to,
most popular man at Elevation.
Yeah. A great dancer at social events as well. But any partner who's listening, who's worked with him will agree. But I said, I was on a call with him. I remember when I was about to join the team, the training team, and I said, well, what's your, one of your favorite parts about working at Elevation? And he said, and he was on the training team at the time. And that's the role that I started on. And he said, you know, when I go to districts, no matter where I go, the EL department or the multilingual learner department is by far the most interesting, exciting, hardworking, passionate group of people in any school that I've been to. Both of us former teachers. I said, that's really, you know, because I taught high school Spanish, there's still language, but a totally different, really, environment. And he's absolutely right about that. I mean, I would go, whether I was going to a district like Dallas, right, or Broward County with a huge number of ELs, or some very small district in Mississippi or Alabama or New Jersey, it was always the same. These like bastions, it was just unbelievable. And so I think that we have the people to be able to, like you said, kind of get up every morning and do the work. And what we're trying to do, obviously, support them with the resources that they need to do that well. And actually that kind of transitions nicely into my next question here, and just a couple more for you. But one thing, so you mentioned Dallas, and like when people think about English learners that are outside of the kind of the world of EL education, they probably think about districts like Dallas or Miami or Los Angeles or New York. But one of the points that you make in your presentation, I thought was really, really cool, and it's true, is you say the fastest EL growth has happened in places where ELs are still a novelty. Tell us more about that. What does it mean for educators in those places and just in general?
Yeah. Oh, I mean, it's just one of the most fascinating things, I think, in our field. It's also a real, to the extent we had, you know, any insight when we started Elevation, I think this was an insight that we had that was really important for our success. Yes. So so Steve knows this, you know this, but like, for the people on the radio here, one of the things I like to do at the very start of, sort of employee training is I do a quick round robin quiz where I ask people, tell me the fastest growing states in terms of English learner populations. And I very explicitly tell them that they're not allowed to think about the answer. It has to be like a Rorschach test. Like, give me the thing that's right at the top of your lizard brain. What's your initial gut reaction? And always people say California, Texas, Florida, New York.
Yep. The ones I mentioned.
And of course, those are totally wrong. Totally wrong answers, because those states already have large numbers of English learners. I mean, it wasn't that long ago that California and Texas were a part of Mexico, right? And so naturally, those states are well accustomed to English learners. And while those numbers are growing, they're not growing that much because they're already super big. It's a law of large numbers issue. 9 out of the 10 fastest growing states are in the Southeast, the American Southeast, like what we would historically know as the classic Confederacy. It's, you know, start at Virginia, go all the way down to Georgia and up to Arkansas and like every state in that quadrant, in that triangle there. And that's important for several reasons. One, and by the way, that's the region I grew up in too. So I always had a lot of kind of empathy for that dynamic. I felt like I had an opportunity to see that dynamic faster than some other people maybe.
Sure.
But it meant a couple things for the country and meant a couple things for elevation. For the country, it meant that quietly we were getting much more diverse than people really totally appreciated. English learners used to be considered by most school boards and most municipal governments and things to be an issue that like, yeah, large urban centers or maybe the Rio Grande Valley would have, but not the suburbs of Atlanta or surely not, you know, Roanoke, Virginia, right? That's not where you'd have English learners. And sure enough, total opposite's true, right? For a host of reasons, including economic growth and the like, reinforcing immigration patterns. It's been that region has seen massive growth, 4 or 5 times growth over the last, you know, 15, 20 years. And so for elevation, the quiet little secret there was we started serving districts in the Southeast. That's how we got our start. And at the time, just like any startup, we had a pretty clumsy product. It wasn't very good at the start. That's how most companies start. But relative to the solutions that districts in North Carolina or Georgia or Virginia had at the time, we way exceeded anyone's expectations.
Right.
We were a huge help to districts that needed a lot of support and had very little experience working with this population of kids. And so that gave us an opportunity to kind of grow in the fastest part of the country, learn what we needed to know. And then after a few years, built our confidence, got the product to a better place. Then we were able to kind of go to the, let's call it the more experienced states, Texas, Florida, California. And then we had a whole nother learning curve to get up. But I think from a policy perspective, one of the reasons why I think, like going back to the policy questions, one of the reasons why I think some of these English learner policies have been more enduring and I feel like as good as I do about them is because it is such a shared experience now. It's not something that, oh, well, McAllen in Texas needs to know about. Actually, you are just as likely to need to really know how to work with English learners if you live in Norfolk, Virginia, or Bentonville, Arkansas, right? Like these are places that themselves have very diverse communities now. And so everyone cares about English learners. Everyone wants to serve them more effectively. Everyone knows that their own economies are absolutely dependent on those EL students emerging from their school districts with the skills they need to be productive contributors to the democracy and to their economy.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, we talk about politics on this podcast and we talk about politics in our company because like we're in the political sphere, but by and large, I think that's a very bipartisan message and bipartisan objective. People can have different beliefs about these things, but ultimately we all want really well-educated, multilingual, members of our communities. Right. And that's what we're working on.
Yeah, 100%. I think that's kind of like the hidden secret, and probably not for many people that are listening to this now that are, you know, they're listening from these smaller districts. But I think that's a nice, kind of a nice way to wrap things up. I have a million more questions for you, but we're going to have to do this again sometime because I don't want this to go on forever. So I'm going to ask you one more question. And that's a question that I ask everybody who comes on the podcast. I hope you're prepared. You know, I think that I ask everybody if there's a book, and this is like a largely selfish question, by the way, because my bookshelf is now stocked with these books. We do put out a summer reading list for that includes some of these books. So we'll see if yours makes it. We put out 10.
Yeah.
So is there a book right now that's or a book that you've read just in the past that's had kind of a profound influence on you, either personally or professionally? It could be a beach read or it could be a really like academic read. And I know you're an avid reader, so what would you recommend?
So this is, I knew you asked me this question, and also I'm absolutely stumped about how to respond. I'm gonna cheat and give you one book and then one podcast and two totally different topics. Okay,
I should actually open it up to podcasts too, because
come on, you're a podcast guy.
It's true.
So let me start with the book. This might surprise people, because I'm not particularly, I grew up going to church. I was an altar boy for many years.
I did not know that.
But I'm not a particularly religious person. You might call me a secular churchgoer or something. I don't know what the label would be. But you know, when I started Elevation, and even today, when I think about our work at Elevation, I am sometimes like, I'm very intrigued and mystified by the influence of, you know, my own religious background and convictions as it relates to like why we do this work. And so I'm reading a book right now that is called Dominion by the historian Tom Holland, who's like super interesting dude. And it's all about the spread and rise of Christianity in like the early years. But the reason why it's interesting to me is it's about why the ideas that are in the New Testament were so attractive and revolutionary at the time. And we take all of that for granted now. It's just in the water. It's in our civilization, especially in our civilization. But for me, there's something very important about the work we do that ties back to some beliefs I have about the importance of meeting the stranger, right? Serving the stranger, welcoming the stranger. That's an important part of the book of Matthew. And this notion of charity and compassion for people who have less than we do, and that who come to our country with often very little other than like an unbelievable drive and a lot of belief,
which is a lot.
you know, that to me remains a major inspiration for why I do the way I do. And again, you know, I don't want to get on like a religious high horse. It's really not the point, but I'm like one of these people who's not really a big believer in the more fantastical elements of organized religion, but I still am sitting there going, boy, do I find this compelling and interesting. Like, I always want to learn more about it. So Dominion by Tom Holland. And then different, but certainly related to language, there's a podcast I recommend to everyone who will listen to me. And it's called The History of English Language Podcast. And it's by this like North Carolina lawyer who like, I guess, just stopped doing his job to do this podcast. And it's so nerdy, but I love it so much. It's an etymology podcast. And it goes from like the very earliest days up and through, you know, today. Like, why is the English language what it is? And every episode is just like an eye-opener revelation about why we speak the way we do, the weird structure of English language, why it is the way it is. I've learned so much listening to this podcast. And if you care about language and you're like, okay, being kind of nerdy about it, it's super great.
How have we not talked about this? I feel like this should have come up, but
I know. Well, it's here it is.
It's coming up now, but I feel like you've been listening to this for a while. And
tell the whole world about it.
Oh, okay, good. Okay, well, that makes sense then, because yeah, I feel like you've had occasion to tell me about it, but you want to.
Hey, can I finish with like a little anecdote from the podcast?
Yeah, please.
So, in the Middle Ages, when universities and schooling became, I wouldn't say common, but it became more common for nobles to send their kids to learn Latin mostly. They would send them to what were called grammar schools. And grammar at the time didn't really mean grammar like what we mean now. It's more like general knowledge, right? And only like maybe 1 or 2 or 5% of the population would go to these schools, and they would sort of like go to boarding school and then come back a couple of years later speaking this new weird language and being able to write these symbols that no one could understand. And so common people would frequently miss. They would frequently misunderstand education for something more like a like black magic or sorcery, right?
Yeah.
So we have a lot of words that are actually descriptions of academic disciplines or academic outcomes that have two meanings, one sort of academic and one sort of mystical. So an example, grammar now means like the study of English, of language structure, right? But that got kind of bastardized by the Scots and it came back as glamour. And glamour means, original intent of glamour was someone who like was really ravishing and could kind of cast a spell on you. So it was like it became associated with this like ability to sort of cast spells. Another one is wise and wizard. A wise man is someone who goes to school, but a wizard was a Merlin. But they're the same words. And then the last one that I thought was really interesting is spell. So spell originally meant to kind of break it down, like spell it out for me, or break down a word, which became like spell as we know it today. But that's also why we talk about spells, like a wizard casts spells. So, you know, it's a fascinating, like every episode is something like that, where I just can't wait to tell people about it. And
yeah,
and it's very interesting.
Well, I think you told the right audience, and I'm glad, even though I feel like you've been holding out on me, I'm glad that you told it on the podcast. Okay, well, Teddy Rice, always a pleasure. I feel like we don't get a chance to talk, so we'll have to do more podcasts because we're both really busy, but this was a great conversation. Always appreciate you coming on and all the work that you've done to get us where we are. And I think this is hopefully a good primer for people. And we'll cut it up and put some segments out there as well. And there'll be a blog post as well on it. So, thanks again. Well,
I'm counting on your editing skills to make me sound good here.
Very little editing. That's the wizardry and the wisdom behind the podcast, all conversational. And credit to Haley Sandifer for doing all the editing. Okay. Well, thanks, Teddy. And let's keep in touch.
Yeah. Talk soon. Thanks. Thanks, everyone.
Thanks for listening to Highest Aspirations. If you liked our show, please be sure to join the ELL community at elevationeducation.com/ELL community, where you'll find all the episodes of Highest Aspirations and other resources to help educators maximize the impact on their English language learners. Also, let us know how we're doing by writing a review on iTunes or wherever you listen to your podcasts.